One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Lore Watch, a roundtable freeform discussion about lore in the games of Blizzard Entertainment. I'm your host, Joe Perez, one of several lore aficionados from Blizzard Watch, and I've got my marvelous co-host with me today, Matt Rossi. How are you doing today, Matt?
Apparently, today I'm Matt Rossi.
Well, yeah. I was just reading
this. The part of Matt Rossi will be played today by Matt Rossi.
And we are going to be joined today by our special guest, Crow. Yeah, thank you for coming and joining us.
Always a pleasure, Joe. Thank you so much.
Now, for those of you that don't know, Crow is well-versed in the lore of, well, a lot of things, not just Blizzard. And we've had Crow on before, and I think some of you may remember. And if not, you're in for a treat. So we have a bunch of questions that we're going to get to today. And thanks, everybody, for sending those in. We appreciate it. And for those of you that think you annoy us with all your questions, doesn't bother me at all. Keep sending them in. I love them.
It is kind of what we do.
It is our primary function.
I mean, if you don't write us letters, I mean, we'll come up with something to talk about, but it's not like it's a problem. It's kind of helpful.
But before we get into dive into those questions, I do want to ask you guys, have you been doing anything fun this past week?
Rossi, you go first.
Why would you do this? Nobody established in the pre-show. I mean, come on.
Courtesy.
Why would you do this?
It's a courtesy.
That's not courtesy. That's throwing a grenade and then going, oh, hey, you take it. No. I've been playing a lot of 8.3. I seem to have come upon a completely different perspective than like a lot of people on the internet, which isn't tremendously surprising. I did, however, do one thing that I'm going to talk about. It has nothing to do with lore at all, but I'm going to talk about it. I got my shoulders.
You did. That's what I was hoping you were going to bring up. I'm so excited for you.
It's so fantastic. That's incredible.
Yeah. It only took me 8 freaking years, but you know, hey, whatever. It's finally done.
As somebody who farmed the Dark Shaman Transmog for 462 days, I feel you.
Oh, dude, don't even. Let's not. Okay, 462 days is like a year and a half. This is 8 years.
Oh, I'm not saying that it was worse, but I'm just saying it's in the vein, especially when I saw somebody get the drop 3-4 times in a row.
Oh, see, because that's the thing. That's the thing that really people I loved about this whole time that I was trying to get my shoulders was all the people who'd link me their shoulders.
Yep. I am aware.
But yeah, it's finally over. Steve Denuser will now just have to mock me for my appearance like everybody else because the shoulders, at least at last, are finally mine. And I'm spending a lot of time coming up the transmogs for them because I don't think I'm ever going to transmog away from them. And the best part for me was people on Twitter going, you can get that model from something else. I'm like,
it's not the same.
Do you understand? Like, I didn't want them for the model. The model, frankly, it's not that great. It's okay, but it's not the best shoulder armor Blizzard ever made or anything. I want them because they're named after me. I don't think I'm ever going to have another item named after me in a major, you know, MMORPG. So I kind of want the ones that are named after me. And 8 years down the road, I finally got them. That's it. It wasn't looking for the model, guys. I already had the model. I've had the model for 8 years. Because I got those shoulders from that raid at the time because I was tanking it. It was very much the name. So, yeah, that's done. So, yeah. At this point, I don't really have anything else to obsessively hunt for in the game. There's nothing else I really want. I'm not a mount collector, and I have, like, the mounts that I wanted anyway. So, yeah, I guess I'm done with that until something else comes along and makes me obsess over it. Which is fine by me. Quite frankly, I'm okay with not having that monkey on my back anymore.
Crow, what about you?
Yeah, let's move on to somebody other than me.
one of the great sins of my existence is that I actually have not been leaning too much into World of Warcraft lately because I fell into a rabbit hole filled with cat girls and bunny girls called Final Fantasy 14.
Yes.
But you know, I made a concerted effort to come back this week, you know, not only with 8.3 dropping, but also because there's just a notable amount of content in Battle for Azeroth that I haven't completed yet. So the thing that I focused on when I came back was I had never actually done the Night Warrior scenario. So I went ahead and you know, leaned into that. And it was a really interesting experience to go through and realize, no, they could have made this much more cinematic. I know that they did everything in game and it didn't look bad. It looked good. It was well performed and everything about it was all right, but it was definitely, we are going to give the Night Elves a victory and we are going to give them, you know, as almost as pyrrhic of a victory as we can possibly give them without burning down their tree again. And that was something about that experience that was striking to me at the time. Because it's just like, come on, guys, can we give the Night Elves a win at some point? Just an unambiguous win? That'd be great.
That's actually pretty cool. It's nice to hear that from somebody who, because I haven't stopped or taken a break, so it's nice to hear somebody coming back and getting their take on that. Meanwhile, this week I've been prepping for Nyalotha, and I took a screenshot of this the other day and I tweeted it out. Whoever designed and painted the skybox for that raid, I just want to hug them. It is freaking gorgeous.
No kidding.
Jeez. Like the way in for me, because of like the art side of things, I love when people use purples and pinks and oranges because you don't see them used in concert very often, and having it done to that skill level, just, I mean, chef kiss.
Yeah, definitely.
But with that
the
said,
the game keeps getting prettier. I mean, that is one thing that does. You can definitely say about the game, regardless of anything else. Your feelings on plot movements or lore movements or anything along those lines, you know, is obviously a matter of debate and something that obviously Lorewatch as a podcast has existed for a long, long time. But the art of Warcraft, the art of how this game looks has just been, it has never gotten worse. It has always gotten better, and it's hit some incredible highs before and then just keeps topping it. Like, I still go back to Mists of Pandaria and realize, wow, there is lots of pretty stuff here, and I wish I didn't have to leave. I also wish we didn't, like, destroy the place, but I wish, you know, we could just retire here and be okay. And I'm so happy that the veil is fixed now.
That's a weird thing to say, because for me, that was Warlords.
Yeah.
Warlords was very pretty too.
In terms of looks. And not only that, but it was where I actually did retire a character. I was raiding on a Draenei warrior at the time. And as I was playing the game, I kept saying to myself, why would I leave? Like, I've come to a place where here are my people. They haven't been slaughtered. They're not dead. It was very easy to justify him staying there. And that's when I switched, actually. If you remember the Legion, before Legion actually came out, there was the invasion event they were doing where you could do it at any level and they were hitting like Hillsbrand and all that. Like Helcular would be like, you know, there. And that, by the way, that was the funniest thing ever when Helcular would be like, go forth, destroy these impudent invaders. And it was like, geez, Helcular, you're at a 12 and I'm going to let you stay at a 12, but you're really at a 12. But I remember thinking, there's no reason for me to bring my Draenei to this. My Draenei is done. He's done his bit. He's, you know, when I was playing him, I always played him as being really freaking old, because I figured he was one of the old guard before they all got super light happy. So yeah, I retired him and I started this Night Elf thinking, oh wow, Legion will be a great expansion to go in as a Night Elf. And I've had some thoughts about that since. But yeah, that's so. And I leveled her from 1 to like, I think it was 100 going into Legion, right? Legion got you to 110 at the end. I leveled her from 1 to 100 doing those invasions, and it flew by.
Yep.
It just flew by. I was like, I remember being level 95 before I even realized it. Like, I don't even think it took me a week of just doing just the invasions when they were up. Because remember at first too, they paced them, and then as they went on, they got faster and faster until they were happening almost continuously.
Right.
And by the time they were happening almost continuously, I was gaining like 5-6 levels in invasion easily. And this is at higher level. This isn't like, you know, when you're like level 20, you do an invasion, you can be level 35 at the end of it. This was more like, you know, okay, I'm going in at level 70. Okay, I'm level 75 now. And there's another invasion, so I'll just go to that one. Okay, now I'm level 90. It was really, the things just went super fast.
So, I remember the devs at that time were even saying that, you know, yeah, maybe this is going a little faster than we intended, but we're not going to do anything about it because people are having a lot of fun. So, you know, yeah, sure. If you guys want to level an alt, now's a good time to do it. Feel free.
Speaking of fun, I think it's time to get into some questions.
Okay, yeah, let's pull the lever on that.
So the first question comes from Jay. Quick question about the Forge of Origination and the time the Tol Vir activated against the Thunder King. My understanding is that Uldum used to be a jungle, but this event turned it into a desert. Am I wrong in thinking that that's where the desert in Tanaris comes from? If so, then was Silithus also reoriginated and turned from jungle closer to Unguro to desert? How come this recrimination didn't destroy C'Thun, or am I not understanding the story? Hope this makes sense. Yeah, who wants to start on that one?
You're not incorrect. The reason the reorigination didn't destroy C'Thun is that A, C'Thun was protected by being locked in a Titan facility. Just like the Tol Vir were protected by being inside the Forge of Origination. Essentially, it wasn't the full power of the Forge, and it was still enough to turn pretty much everything in the area around it into desert. Except Un'Goro. And again, you'll notice Un'Goro is protected by Titan pylons. The petri dish of the Titans didn't get affected by the reorigination blast in much the same way. Titan facilities and Titan technology were sufficient to protect it. Now, the Mogu, being Titan beings, would have been protected had they used the Forge of Origination against their enemies, had they seized control of it. And they would have been protected from it had they been in their facilities, but they were invading Uldum. So they were standing around on the outside, completely vulnerable, when they got hit. And it wasn't just the Mogu, by the way. It was also the Zandalar.
Yes.
The Zandalar suffered tremendous losses as well. And it's one of the reasons, actually, that the Zandalar switched their attempt at conquest in a different direction after that happened. It had long-term effects on them and their stability. But yeah, it was definitely a case of, you know, the Tol Vir wouldn't have used it if it was going to kill them. They used it knowing it's not going to hit us because we're inside it, and it didn't hit any of the other Titan facilities. Because remember, when we used the Forge of Origination this time around, it's revealed that they have to network it to other Titan facilities to get the power necessary to use it. There's not enough power in the Forge of Origination to use the Forge of Origination. The whole thing is one big system. All those different Titan facilities, the ones up in Ulduar, the ones down in you know, Uldum, the ones at Uldumon, all of them, all these Titan facilities are effectively connected.
And we talk about in patch 8.3, there's a whole scenario about that, right? Like, they talk about that and specifically the Halls of Origination, because you go there a few times as you're doing your intro stuff to 8.3. And at this point, I think it's past spoilers. It's been over a week. So, you know, I think it's safe to, we're not going to go into too much detail, but they talk specifically about that. And when you're dealing with the Halls of Origination in general and why you're there, why you're trying to get it back online and everything else, they specifically talk about trying to tune in the power, because where it is right now, it's an all or nothing thing, or as they've seen in the past, if you don't do all, it's sort of ineffective.
Yeah, what's really interesting too is since we're talking about that, I'm going to bring this one up. You find out that one of the reasons the Mogu wanted the Forge was because they had figured out how to use it in a pinpoint way.
Yep.
That's, in fact, yeah. The whole bit about why we're using it now against N'Zoth is because the Mogu had figured out how to use it as a weapon. It's one of the things the Mogu were great at, and they'd figured out, okay, we know how to aim this thing now. But they didn't get it because it got used against them, and they didn't have the force to take it at that point. And that's the interesting thing about all of this, is the Mogu were ready to go. Because that's probably in great part due to what Li Shen took out of Ra'den.
Oh, yeah.
He had the ability to, you know, interface with and understand their equipment. You saw how he was using the engine of Nalak Shah himself. And that's the thing. We go to the engine of Nalak Shah for the power to use the Forge of Origination. So the Mogu were all set. If the Mogu had actually taken the Forge of Origination, they would have had their hands on a button with which they could cleanse the world of all fleshy beings.
Yeah, or just the ones that they, you know, irritated them, or just the cities, or just whatever they wanted. They essentially at that point had the golden eye laser.
Yeah, and so it's a lot of people are saying things about why, you know, how come we're using the Forge this way when we never used it that way before? Well, that's covered in this story. That the quests do, if you actually read the quest text, or if you even just listen to the things that Magni says to you, and I know that's hard. Because every time Magni talks, I start doing a Sean Connery impression, except it's a terrible Sean Connery impression, because it's just him as a Russian sub-captain.
Yeah, pretty much.
But nevertheless, Magni is explaining the whole time what's going on. He tells you. So that's something to keep in mind when we're doing all of this, is that there is actual evidence for what's going on is in the quest text.
So you know. And now you said that, now I just want somebody out there to make a machinima called the Hunt for Red Nyalotha.
I'll get started, man. Let's tell you.
What about you, Crow?
Be the change you want to be in the world, man.
What about you, Crow? Anything you want to add to that one?
I mean, yeah, I'm immediately distracted by recalling how awful Sean Connery's Russian accent was in that film. And like, even Sam Neill was more convincing in every possible way.
But that's okay. Stomper. Azeroth cries out in pain. Seriously, you tell me it's not worse. And, you know, I've got nothing against you, Carlos Lachen. I think you're a great voice actor. It's specifically Magni, because you've done other dwarves and they haven't bothered me. Magni says everything. Like, Magni is one of those characters who says everything like he's just about to pee himself.
Yeah.
And that's fine. Like, when he says it quietly, like the scene in Stormwind where he gets Fearbreaker back, he's fine. It's when he's yelling at you that you're like, dude, dial it down.
And considering that we mostly interact with him in stressful situations in which there's a lot of yelling.
Yeah,
I can kind of understand.
Meanwhile, where Carlos is, that's always my motivation. Every other dwarf I do differently, but Magni is like, oh, he's got to go. He's got to go right. I have to imagine that, you know, that's one of the things that you do when you're a voice actor is like, what do I do to make sure that this character sounds distinct from other characters that are similarly that have similar qualities to them? And it's just like, this guy's got to go to the bathroom.
Well, we found out the real secret of Nyalotha. I don't have to tell you.
But yeah, but
the real secret of Nyalotha is there are no.
But I hope I mean, that answers.
There's no Titan facilities.
But I hope that answers. Well, we don't know that yet. We don't know if Nyalotha is a weird, twisted version of a Titan facility because, and this is something Matt pointed out a long time ago, when we're dealing with like the Heart Maiden, the Maiden of the Maiden of Vitality, and we bring her back online and she's starting to go through all the Titan facilities, we know that there's more old facilities than what we've seen or what we know about, and we don't know where they all are yet. There's tons of them that we don't know where they're named, where they are. And that's made very clear from that. It's entirely possible that Nyalotha is, you know, the twisted, mutated version of one of those facilities.
Or for that matter, I mean, I'm just going to put this out there. One of the things that you get from the quest, if you listen to Raytheon and you listen to other people talking, Nyalotha isn't actually there.
Yeah.
It's not a place. It's essentially, it's like an extraplanar rewrite, because remember, if you go back, we talked about this before, if you go back to N'Zoth, every appearance N'Zoth's ever made, every time he's been spoken about, the Emerald Nightmare, all of that. Nazoth's goal has always been to rewrite Azeroth to be the Black Empire again. And the Nyalotha that we experience, the raid we go into, isn't a real place. It's an extraplanar backup copy. It's, this is what I want the world to be. It's the thing he's going to use. It's effectively, you have to think of the Forge of Reorigination here, the Forge of Origination, as a 3D printer.
Yeah.
And Nyalotha is what he wants to print. And Azeroth is the resin.
Yeah.
That's what, and it's a terrible metaphor, but that's where he's not, going though. With this.
No, I mean, but that, it's a good thing that you bring that up, because I was actually going to bring that up too, because when you go through Nyalotha, when you first see it, the first impressions that I got this week from poking around on it on Wednesday was that it reminded me incredibly of Aldir. Like, the layout of it, the weird, like, the way the pillars were spaced, the way the rooms and layout was moved around, it reminded me very much like a corrupted Nazoth, Nyalothan, you know, version of Aldir. So the fact that you're saying that he wants to, like, recreate it in his image and sort of, like, use Azeroth as a resin, that kind of makes sense. And then when we talk about that skybox and you start looking at it and you see the hills, those rolling mountains, that remind me very, very much of that first glimpse you get of High Mountain when you're looking at, like, the mountain ranges in the side, but more tentacly. Like, it's a perfect metaphor for that, because he's not just... he's not corrupting it. He's remaking it in his image. So I thought it's an interesting thing, I believe. But I hope that answers your question, Jay. If you haven't played through the 8.3 intro stuff, I highly recommend it, simply because it gives you a lot more specifics about this type of stuff. And it's sort of very cool reveals when they come up. Next question we have is from Candy Pop from Stormrage. Do the troll city names, Zul'Farak, Zul'Gurub, etc., have anything to do with Zul, who we killed, or is Zul like the troll word for city, and this guy's name just meant city in troll?
No, Zul is the troll word for great.
Yes.
So, do you think Zul'Farak is great Farak? Zul Amon was great Amon. It's essentially saying, you know, this is the, it's like the greater metropolitan area type thing.
Or almost like a Zul capital.
Zul is the great. For instance, Zul'jin, his name, the Zul in his name meant, you know, great. I forget what the Jin meant. I have not looked that up in a while. I'll go look that up now while we keep talking. But yeah, it just means great. It's like, you know, yeah, that Zul'jin guy is great. Zul is the great one. You know, that's all it is.
The greatest, often imitated, never duplicated. Which is demonstrable by the fact that, you know, Zul'Farak, Zul'Aman, a lot of these places are like the principal central locations of these particular tribes of trolls. But you know that they have other cities, that they have like other, you know, other settlements. Like, you know, we know the Amani have Jintha Alor in the hinterlands. We know that the Gurubashi have more places other than just Zul'Gurub. So there's lots of other places, but it feels like the Zul prefix ends up being used in a city context. It's used for, this is the place that is, you could consider it the capital of this tribe to a vast extent. So I think that's probably the methodology there.
Yeah.
And if you look at a Voldoon, not to interrupt you, but there's Zul Ajin in, mm-hmm. in Voldoon, and there's also Atal Ajin, is Atul Aman there as well, which was where the Amani lived before they moved out.
Ah, right, right.
And over the, you know, the northern areas. Because keep in mind, at one point, all trolls lived around the Zandalar. Like, they were all there. They were all effectively part of Zandalari culture. And then they left and they spread out across the world. Various places. They basically, it feels like, and this isn't stated in game, this is purely just a theory of mine based on the fact that the Zul prefix got applied to places like Zul'Gurub and Zul'Aman. It's like they didn't dare call their cities Zul'Aman or Zul'Gurub when they were living around the Zandalar. But once they broke away from the Zandalar, they could mm-hmm. use the prefix. They could say, this is Zul'Aman. That's a theory, but we do know that the word is essentially just means great or you know, the great one.
Or it can also be used to refer to master tool master as well, because
absolutely.
There is a bunch of voodoo masters in the WoW RPG, which I know is not canon, but they're borrowing enough from it that I basically consider it so, where Zul was used to basically as a prefix for voodoo master. It's also similar to Atal, like you brought up, where Atal can mean devoted to or in honor of. And so, like, you'll see, like, Atal Hakkar, you know, devoted to Hakkar or in honor of Hakkar. Atal Al, devoted ones. Like, trolls are very big on using those prefixes to sort of signify the importance of something.
Yeah, and it's also an interesting thing. This is when I was looking at the thing online, and I remembered this. You guys remember getting your mallet of Zul'Farrokh, right?
Yes.
I remember the mallet. I might still have the mallet.
When you get it, you have to get it at the Altar of Zul. It's just the Altar of Zul. It's not the Altar of Zul anything. And it's almost certainly not an altar dedicated to the Zul the Prophet, because it predates his existence by some time. Why is it the Altar of Zul? Is it named after a specific troll? Is it named after a god? Is there a god who's just called Zul? Or is it like, is it like the thing where sometimes instead of saying a god's name, they'll use like a euphemism for it? Like, do they just say the Great One to, rather than saying the name of whatever god they mean? Like, is it dedicated to that mysterious death Loa, whose name I can never remember, or Mala something?
Moizala,
thank you. It could be that. But there's the whole there's the Empire of Zul.
Yep.
Which was a coalition of troll tribes, you know, during the Aquir and Troll War, which essentially was just, you know, called the Empire, the Great Empire, because it was all trolls. It was all troll tribes working together to try and destroy the Aquir. And that's the word, again, it has multiple meanings. It's a very flexible word, but it doesn't just mean city, no.
Yeah, but I was going to say, interestingly enough, too, that you bring that up, I remember something as well where Zul can also be used without the apostrophe to denigrate. Because I remember Zulfi being used in game to refer to like corrupted voodoo masters, like basically baby witch or bad witch. I remember that, which I thought was always interesting. So you're right. It's a super incredibly versatile word. Trolls, they have a very interesting language. Who would have thought?
There's a linguistic quality to this that I think is interesting, and we're limited to an extent because, you know, in English, you know, letters don't necessarily have a lot of different, when you arrange letters into words, they don't necessarily always have different meanings. Like, you have some homonyms and homophones that are out there, but it isn't something like you have in Chinese or Japanese, which obviously, I mean, even actually that's a terrible example to bring up in particular, but brief explanation. In Japanese, you have a specific kanji that, you know, you can read them one particular way in Japanese. You can read it a different particular way in Japanese, or there's even Chinese meanings that are associated with the same kanji that in context makes sense. But you wouldn't translate the same kanji into the same words in English necessarily, because of how the context would be different. The point I'm trying to make is that we're seeing renderings of troll language, you know, all written in, you know, our real world English so that we're able to read it. And obviously it's being developed by people for whom the primary language is English. But I think there's a possibility that there are linguistic complexities to troll language that we don't really see communicated in game that might help to differentiate, well, the Prophet Zul has Zul rendered this way in the troll language, but then all of the different Zul cities would have their names spelled in a way that differentiates those two. So even though it looks like Zul and it sounds like Zul when you say it, the contextually how it's written might be communicated differently. So
This is kind of interesting when you think about the various elven languages,
mm-hmm.
because Darnassian and Shalassian, which is the Nightborn one, and Thalassian, which is the high elf, so now both void elves and blood elves, all use the word quell.
Yes.
And the word quell essentially means high. But it has a lot of different contextual meaning depending on what you're talking about. But for an example, Medivh called the named the sword that Anduin Lothar used Quel'Zaram, which meant the High Blade in Thalassian. Now, we know of two other blades with the Quel'Salar?
Quel'Salar. Yep.
Quel'Dalar.
Yep.
And both effectively mean, I think Quel'Dalar means the sister blade, but it would obviously, Quel means high. It doesn't mean blade. But I think that what you're talking about here is like a word that can be used to mean, you know, high as in lofty, or it can be used essentially to mean a sword. And there's a lot of interesting interplay, because one of the things that Elven would be derived from Trollish, even if the elves don't want to admit it, because the ancestors of the elves were trolls.
Yep.
So if that's the case, if Elven is derived from Trollish, then you're in a situation where, again, the fact that words can have these like contextual meanings based entirely on their use, that's not that different from modern languages. It's just not a very... Languages so, derived from Latin don't do that, but a lot of other languages do, even Indo-European languages, like, you know, Greek even has some of that.
Here's something I really always wanted in the game, and this question sort of brings me back to this a little bit. Sort of a weird tangent. So when you played other games, some games actually like bring in linguistic experts to make a language, like an original language that makes sense in context. And the best example I can think about that is Far Cry Primal by Ubisoft. They actually had somebody who their entire job was to create a language that was capable of being understood without being understood. Basically, you didn't have to know the words to understand intent, but it was an actual language.
What's interesting about that is that language is based on Indo-European.
Yes.
It's based on Proto-Indo-European, actually, yes, which is a thing that they've been doing for years. But you're reminding me of what BioWare did with Jin Empire.
I was going to bring that up as well. Yeah, that was the other one I was going to bring up. But one thing I've always
wanted them to do that is, like, I mean, you know, I know that Star Wars had Michael Okuda pick up. And I know that before Michael Okuda, James Doohan was actually the guy who created the original Klingon.
Mm-hmm.
That was Scotty made that up, because he was a linguist and a signal. He was a Signal Corps guy in the war, and that was actually James Doohan who did that. I've always wanted them to hire somebody to do it, and then to make like Duolingo for Azeroth.
Yes, I was,
because
the point I was going to get to. Like, you and I are in the same wavelength here, because that's something I've always wanted, and it's because over the years we've seen, not just with the trolls but the elves, we've seen some very interesting, like, we've seen the root of what could be a full-blown language. And I would love to see them at some point have a linguist come in and actually make them, like, into full-blown logical languages, or at least the framework for one. And I don't know about you guys, but I would absolutely, like, buy those primers, and those would be things that I would go through and read and enjoy, not just because it adds an interesting depth, but because I think it adds sort of like a unity going forward for these races in the game that I don't want to say they don't have, but.
Well, no, I mean, it's fair to say that, you know, look at dwarves. There's like a few dwarven words. There's not very many.
Not much. Yeah, we don't have much of it.
Like, I mean, like, we know Khadgar means keeper of secrets in dwarven, but that's basically it. No, sorry, it's the other way around. Medivh means keeper of secrets. Khadgar means like honest.
Yes. Trust.
That's right.
Trust.
Yeah, trust. So we know that there's a few, but there really could be a lot more, especially at this point. You could just sit down and, like, especially with elves, you've seen a lot of it, because there's so many different, like, elves in the game. Like,
mm-hmm.
There's, like, the Horde has almost more elves than the Alliance at this point, which is just okay. But there's a ton of elves. There's a ton of elven languages. They all kind of look enough alike that I don't get why no one can talk to each other. Like, I'm sorry, you haven't made Thalassian different enough from Darnassian that a Night Elf and a Blood Elf couldn't have a conversation. If a Catalan speaker can speak to, like, you know, somebody who speaks, you know, Spanish from Mexico or Bolivia,
I was just going to say something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Then a Night Elf, like, should be able to talk to a Blood Elf.
Yeah. And that's something that I would like to see addressed at least later on, is because, and this is me as a Hispanic, Spanish speaking person, and my wife, who's also a Spanish-speaking person, but we have two different dialects, we can still understand each other for the most part. There are things that get lost in translation, but I'd love to see something like that happen in game where, like, you know, you have the Thrissian and the Quel'Dorei, and they're just talking to each other, and they're like, oh, okay, and they can actually communicate in their native language, not having to actually use common. That'd be cool. But moving on from there, we do have a question from Neo Penguin here. A question for Lore Watch. After last week's episode, y'all have me pretty convinced that the big bad will be Tyrann for the expansion after next, because the Jailer is looming, you know. So do you think this could occur? It would set up the Alliance to get that deep story that only seems to come with interesting Horde bad guys. I'll let you have this one first, Rossi, since I know you have strong feelings about Elves.
Crow is here. Why don't we let Crow talk for a bit? That's how it feels, man. There's a nice grenade for you to jump on. Have fun, Crow.
Grenades, so delicious. I actually have been thinking about this a little bit, because I mean, especially with just going through the Night Warrior thing, it's like, you know, this is the moment that really gives a great deal. It puts a lot of attention on Tyrande and has her grow past this notion of being this, you know, loyal and, you know, completely faithful priestess of Ilune. With everything that she's been through in the last couple of expansions, it's like her faith has been tried again and again and again. And she, you know, basically gives up on it and decides, I'm going to do this Night Warrior thing, and I'm going to kick the living daylights out of everybody who tries to stop me from kicking the living daylights out of the Horde, because screw those guys. They burned down my tree. I don't know if that necessarily gets to the extent of Tyrande becoming a opposing force for the Alliance, in addition to being an opposing force for the Horde. But I also really hope that there's a way that we can have somebody on the Alliance have a heel turn, like half the people on the Horde have had a heel turn so far. Because, yeah, I want that to happen, not because I want anybody on the Alliance to go bad, but because if having somebody on your faction go evil is the way to get good character development on your faction, then the Horde has had plenty of that and the Alliance has not, and I'm interested to see the Alliance get some of that. Tyrande is probably closer to it than any of the other leaders we have right now, but that, you know, isn't something we have to limit to just leaders. We could always have, like, new characters crop up and become, you know, that kind of opposition in the future. Like, I'm not going to say I want Talia Fordragon to have a heel turn, but I also wouldn't say no, because, you know, awesome girl with a big hammer whose daddy is the king of the dead. Sure. Yeah, she can go evil and awesome. I'd be okay with that.
I'm definitely on board with the idea of having a more complex character development on the Alliance side. And I understand the sentiment that Neo Penguin's getting at here. And I'm saying this as a Horde player, predominantly a Horde player. We have had a lot of really interesting character development. Heck, even the end of the Alliance War campaign was basically just another excuse to watch a Horde story finish up, because that's what it was. And while I love that, I do feel that the Alliance over the years haven't really gotten that sort of depth that I think players really want. And I'm not saying that there isn't story there. There is. And what's there is definitely, it's good. It's just, we want more of it. And we see some of the seeds that are starting to be sown right now. And we talked about this a few episodes ago, where we're starting to have sort of that tension with Anduin, right? Where all of his leaders they're not in agreement anymore. They're not just falling in line. They're not just, you know, accepting what he says as, yep, well, I'm going to do whatever he says. He's the High King or the leader of the Alliance. So sure, why not? But you have Ghen Greymane, who's been hurt and wounded so, so much at this point, almost lost everything three times over at this point. You know, of course he's going to be complicated and he should have some feels and some character development. And over the years he's developed from a one note aggressive, you know, dog to, you know, something more complex, having emotions. And Tyrann, who has largely been, I don't want to say up until this point ineffective, but she's been very straight and narrow. Like, there's one path, this is how it's going to be. That's the end of it. Now she's starting to understand that the path that is sometimes you are given isn't the path that you have to walk or that you should walk. And I would like to see more, maybe not necessarily of her being a big bad, but I wouldn't mind a story of her going rogue or her going, you know, a little bit too far into the Night Mother's embrace. You know, because again, we know Alun has abandoned, or at least that's the feeling of it, because that's the predominant story that we're getting from the Forsaken elves that were raised. And that's the story that we get from, well, Tyrande at this point, is that Alun has abandoned her people. Why? What if that leads her down this really dark path? And we don't know what's going to happen with Shadowlands. We know she's going to feature predominantly. We don't know what's going to happen there. What if that just leads her to make some really dark and really like revenge driven, desperate decisions? It doesn't necessarily have to be evil. And that's the thing, like it could be complex. And I'd like to see some of that complexity for her, because I honestly think she has that potential to be even more interesting of a character, kind of like how Jaina got that depth through adversity. I'd like to see Tyrande do that a little bit more too, because I think it'd be cool. I think that'd be nice. And like you said, Crow, I would like to see maybe other characters step up through the Alliance and sort of feed that, because essentially that's what Garrosh was for the Horde, right? Like he was I hate to say like a new character, but he was really like he was introduced and then became incredibly prominent and then had this incredible arc one way or another, whatever you feel about it. It was definitely important. And at the time, like when he was introduced, he was new. He wasn't anybody that had been there since, you know, Orcs versus Humans. So I'd like to see more depth. I'd like to see more interesting things happen with Alliance specific characters. I think it's their time. I want more Alliance centric story.
Yeah. I will, now that I've gotten you guys to talk some, because didn't want to go off before other guys got to talk. First off, I don't think Tyrande is going to be the big bag at any point. I think that Tyrande has always kind of been the person who does what she thinks is right, regardless of the cost. I mean, if you go back to Warcraft 3, when she, like, you know, tells the Sentinels, get out of my way, and when they don't, they die for it. Tyrande is not somebody who's ever been afraid to, you know, make a decision and go with it. So that's the first thing. I think that everything we've seen so far has been in line with that. It hasn't really been a change in her personality. It fits what we saw in Legion, where she's given the option, you know, you have to, you know, you can go deal with this thing that I'm doing, or you can come save Malfurion. And she picks her duty. She picks going to stop Ysera over going to save Malfurion, because Malfurion can take care of himself. And more importantly, she is the High Priest of Alun. And the interesting thing here is that what we've learned in this expansion is that Alun is not a simple goddess. Because the Night Warrior isn't giving up your faith. It's picking a different aspect of your faith to focus on. Because the Night Warrior is still Alun. It's still the same goddess. It's just, there's that old thing. I used to say it about Superman all the time. A lot of people don't understand it. They always call Superman the Big Blue Boy Scout. And the thing about Superman is, he is the Big Blue Boy Scout until you anger him enough. And then he's the guy who punches Mongol so hard that planets crack around them. He's the guy who can beat Darkseid to a pulp. He's both of those people. Because there's the old Sam Vine saying from Terry Pratchett. You know, if you're ever, like, if someone's ever got you, like, staring straight down the barrel and is going to kill you, pray it's an evil man. Pray it's somebody who wants to get you in their power and gloat over how they've got you. Because a good person who thinks you have to be killed will just kill you and move on. That's where Tyrande is right now. She thinks the Horde needs to be killed. She is not subtle about this thought. She does not trust them. She does not believe that they won't just come back in a year or two or three or five and do this all again. And what evidence does she have of that? The entire history of the franchise. There's never been a franchise. There's never been a point where the Horde doesn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
It can say, oh, we're going to council now. We don't have a war chief. From experience, every single time the Horde tells us, oh, we're going to be peaceful now. You know, though, you know, sure, we did a lot of bad stuff when we were under the Horde, blood fever. But now we've unified to fight off the Legion, and now we're good. And it took 5 years. for them to start being aggressive again. You know, 4 years have passed, and then, okay, we're going to start like attacking Alliance bases and hoorah for the Horde. And that continues. And from the perspective of the Alliance, they have how many destroyed cities that they can look at and say, okay, you, that one's you too. I mean, they destroyed Stormwind at one point, but okay, that was a different Horde. That, you know, we're different now. We've changed. Oh, you kind of destroyed Gilneas. Okay, okay. But that was Garrosh making us do that. And, you know, oh, you also blew up Theramore. Again, Garrosh. Okay. All right. And you just burned down... Not, you didn't just burn down the tree. Cause we make the jokes and talk about, you know, oh, yeah, they'll burn down another tree. There were thousands of people on that tree, and you killed them. They're dead.
Yep.
You marched right... And on the way to do that, you destroyed... You poisoned the people in Estranar. You burned the entirety of Darkshore on your way up to burn Teldrassil and kill all those people. So you killed a bunch of other people too. And
you, can't really pin that on anybody else.
Yeah, well, you can. They're gonna pin it on somebody else. That was Sylvanas' fault. But who made the plan? Sarfang. Who, you know, whose idea was this ultimately? Yeah, Sylvanas was like, come up with a plan, but it was Sarfang who did it. And in order to do it, he dishonorably attacked Malfurion from behind while he was basically going to wipe Sylvanas off the face of the planet. And, you know, we can say, oh, she's got her new spooky power now, but, you know, she didn't think she could win.
Which is kind of funny when you think about it, right? Like, Malfurion, I think about Malfurion a fight between...
I wouldn't put anybody up against Malfurion Stormrage and think they had a good chance of winning.
No, no. He's more powerful than people give him credit for.
That guy decides he's going to wipe something out. The problem Malfurion has is he always wants to try and do like
the right thing.
Traumatized from the one thing he did that kind of had some significantly bad effects. That time he blew up the planet. And we keep forgetting that was Malfurion who did that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know...
You know, yeah, yeah. My bad on that one.
There's Tyrande's got a lot going on in terms of that. That's the thing. Right now, there's a lot going on that I don't think makes her a bad person, and I think in a way that's better for storytelling. And it's one of the things that I think people kind of miss about Sylvanas. Is Sylvanas quote unquote evil? Yes, and she always has been.
Yeah.
But what she's doing, it makes sense from her perspective. And that's the thing. She's not a, you know, mustache twirling supervillain who gets off on hurting people unless they're people who've done something to frustrate her. But I think the real moment to note is when at the end of 8.2.5, when you go see Sylvanas, if you're a Sylvanas loyalist, if you go see her at Windrunner Spire, she's like, you know, I really did want to help them. And she's talking about the Forsaken. I really did. I understood what they were going through. I wanted to make it stop. But one way or another, it's going to stop. And her plans aren't as simple as you know, I'm bad, I do bad things. What we're going to see in Shadowlands is going to be like, what exactly is her vision? What is she doing?
And we talk about that a lot. Like, the reason that Sylvanas is such a good villain is not because she is mustache twirling. It's because she's complex. Yes, she's evil. Her motivations definitely have that tinge to them. But she's complex. She has a lot of things. Like you're saying, her plans aren't simple. It's not, you know, I have sharks with lasers on their head. Give me $1 billion. It's a long game. It's plans within plans within plans. And it makes for a very interesting villain, a very interesting foil. And I think Tyrande doesn't have to be evil to be that same level of complex and interesting. Well, yeah, and like you said, it's that motivation, right?
She can be, like I said with Viam's quote, she can be a, you know, quote unquote, morally a good person who cares for her people
and
wants to do what's right for them and decide, I'm going to wipe out this place the Horde holds because they're a danger to my people and they've been proved to be a danger to my people how many times? So, yeah, you thought Camp T was bad? Say goodbye to, like, I don't know, all of Ashara. Every Horde base in the zone of Ashara gets taken out.
And
I could see her doing that. And, you know, it would be mass killing, and it's a bad thing to do. It's an evil act, but it makes sense from her perspective.
Well, especially with Kalimdor in general, like, I could see her trying to push the Horde out.
Well, right now, she's sitting up on Mount Hyjal. She is canonically in control of Hyjal.
Yep, she's in the high ground. She literally has the high ground.
Yeah, she's looking down at every horde, you know, as Shara and Orgrimmar are right there underneath her.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've talked about this before, that it's quite possible that she could, like, start dropping fireballs on the horde territories from up there.
Well, especially... I was going to say, because we talked about this before with, like, fire druids, right? That's one possibility. But also the thing that I think is overlooked, while Taran may not have been, like, the biggest fan of, like, mages at first, her outlook may have changed. And she's sitting on literally a font of arcane power.
We should talk about that. They put in at the end to Darkshore.
Go for
it. Did you see that? Crow, you saw that? That they put that in?
No, I think I may have missed that one. Help me out.
Okay. They put in a new ending quest to Darkshore, where after a victory, I think maybe they put it in to coincide with Heroic Darkshore, I'm not sure. But after a victory, you basically, Maiev grabs you and says, yeah, we're going to go listen to Taranda. She's got some stuff to say. And Taranda basically says, you know, thanks to, you know, you all here, and thanks to our allies, the Worgen, and thanks to all of the efforts of our people, we've reclaimed Darkshore. The Horde attempted to slaughter us and steal our land, but we have pushed them out. And, you know, we will continue because we are the Kaldari. And it's not a big deal. It's a very small thing. And I do think it's one of those moments where I find myself saying, what, we couldn't have cut one of the sad orc cries over, like, you know, massacring people to get a full rendered cinematic of this, or even just an in-game cinematic of this. But at the same time, I still find it, like, it's good progression in that it closes the books on that. It straight up tells you the Night Elves won Darkshore.
Which is good. Battle,
you know, and it's in-game, so... The thing about that is, one of the people who's there is that arcanist, Mordant Evenshade, I want to say his name is, the highborn magician, the one that first goes to Darnassus all the way back in Cataclysm and is like, hey, we want to rejoin, we want to be Night Elves.
Yeah, Mordant Evenshade.
He's there.
Oh.
He's at her side.
Oh, he's the leader of the Shendralar.
Yeah, and he's there. Like, he shows up.
There you go.
At the ceremony. And, you know, I mean, that's one of those things that we keep thinking that the Night Elves that we have are the Night Elves we had in 2004.
They're not
or
anymore.
Even 2002, you know, but they're not. This is it. I think between this and the Nightborn, the thing with the Nightborn was a pretty big blow. The fact that they joined the Horde and gave the Horde that much more arcane power, and they already had quite a bit. And then this, I think at this point, the Night Elves are absolutely not going to look their noses up at the Arcane anymore. They not only know what it can do,
oh,
they know,
you know
how dangerous it is.
Yeah, because he was at Ashwood Depot, wasn't he? In the Darkshore, the Battle for Darkshore. He was there fighting.
Yeah, and now he's there. They're not... It's interesting because, you know, for 10,000 years, this civilization of Night Elves, the Kaldari, turned their backs on everything that, like, the Nightborn held dear, everything the Highborn held dear. They turned their backs on the Arcane, and now they're in a position where they may start using it again. And if they do, that's going to change the fabric of their society.
And you know what? It makes sense too, because if they're in a position where they feel that Alun has abandoned them, and like part of the reason that they moved away from the Arcane, if I remember correctly, and it's been a while since I was a Night Elf main, so I will look to you, Rossi, to keep me honest here. But I remember, like, that was the big debate when the mages were first trying to essentially seek audience with Tyrande and become part of, you know, Night Elf society again, become part of the Alliance again, was, you know, this big debate between, we don't need the Arcane, we have the Light of Alun, but now that Light of Alun is gone, and, like, that's been such a key feature. Well, if they don't have that anymore, what other argument do they have left? Like you said, like, all this devastation that they faced, everything else that's happened, why wouldn't they welcome it? Why wouldn't they welcome power?
Well, I think that people are overstating the idea that Alun has abandoned them. Like, the idea is, when Taranda says, what she says at the end of this expansion, she's like, why did she allow this to happen?
Well, and
it's not
that
Alun isn't there. It's not that Alun isn't there. It's that, why is this what Alun wants? Why, you know, because the Night Warrior, Taranda didn't just ask for it. Because remember, everybody else who's asked to be the Night Warrior died.
Yeah.
They got blown the heck up. Taranda didn't ask. She went to Aluna and said, you will give me this. I am doing this. You picked me. And that's the thing. People forget this. Taronda didn't want to be High Priest. 10,000 years ago, it was Ilune that came to Taronda and not the other way around. Taronda, there was already a perfectly viable candidate for High Priest, and it was Maiev Shadowsong. Maiev Shadowsong had been a priest for years. Maiev Shadowsong had been the High Priestess's right hand. She had every reason to expect she would be chosen to be the High Priest. And instead, Ilune went and picked this novice who'd never been like any more than just like a minor priestess at a minor temple and made her the High Priest. And that was totally not something that Taronda had ever asked for. So Taronda's relationship with Ilune has always been different. And it's because it's been around for so long.
Mm-hmm.
It's been all we've known for how High Priests should act and how it is. But if you go back to the War of the Ancients and you look at, I think her name was Dolanar. Can't remember her name. I have to go look it up. Sorry, I'm old. But her relationship with Ilune was very different. And it was much more along the lines of a passive, taking in what Ilune says. Taronda's never been that one. So when it looks like Ilune has faltered or turned away from them in some fashion, Taronda is going to demand answers. And the Night Warrior ritual is actually very much along those lines. It's her saying, you're going to give this to me. And again, they have a clear example of Ilune's power because it's permanently freaking eclipse time in Darkshore right now. The sun doesn't get to be there. The moon is just in front of it all the time. And that's pretty weird.
Yeah.
That's not what moons awful. Do. It's like, I honestly do find myself wondering, like, you know, where this is going to go. And I do think it's going to tie into the Ardenweald storyline. I think we're going to find out that Ilune's power in some way has been compromised by the same thing that's, you know, created all the other problems, the soul drought in Ardenweald. But we don't really know much about that yet, obviously.
It's one of those things where, you know, the insistence throughout the history of the franchise, really, the insistence at saying that Ilune is most definitively a god, and all of the other things that are referred to as gods or godlike beings, you know, are still not necessarily gods. They're titans, or they're very powerful demons, or they are titans who are bossing around a lot of demons. But Ilune was always something that was established to be apart from all of that. Ilune is a god in some manner. And the fact that we've never really had a clear explanation for what that means or what she is. And I always love going back to Anne's, you know, past theories about Ilune being a Naru, because that would be something that would totally make sense. But now that so much of that seems to have been disproven,
Although you can't really argue the fact that the Tear of Ilune reactivated a prime Naru.
Yeah, no, yep. That's still definitely there. I shouldn't say disproven as much as complicated. But it's definitely one of those things where it's like, wait, what? What is going on? And so where is Ilune in all of this? And it also makes me think about how, like, in Warcraft Orcs and Humans and in Warcraft Tides of Darkness, when you're playing humans and you spawn a church, you hear them, you know, speaking Latin. And yeah. The manuals had lots of references to angels and
yeah, know, God. Yeah, because Proto-WoW was based off of the definitive, you know, God and Devil track, more or less.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing is that, you know, but you can tell that they started moving away from that and focusing on the light and not wanting to do a lot of overt sort of Christian stuff because of concerns about it causing, you know, publicity issues. But you know, now you have this situation where we're asking a lot of questions about Ilune that you could hear people asking about, you know, the Christian God to a certain extent. It's like, why does God let this happen? Why does Ilune let all these terrible things take place? Except here we might actually get answers, which is nice.
And I think one thing I want to just key in on that Rossi said that I find is absolutely fascinating. And it's something I've been thinking about for a while too, in specifically in regards to the Tear of Ilune. The Tear of Ilune was corrupted, not switched to a dark cycle, not voided out, but corrupted in a weird way when we saw Xavius using it, which, you know, like I said, you, or like you said, makes the relationship a lot more complicated. If this is a piece of like a divine entity that could be twisted and like molded like that, what does that mean?
Here's a weird thing too to think about when you're thinking about that. How did it get cleansed? Like a loon could just cleanse it. So yeah. Nazoth could corrupt it and
like how much
could cleanse it?
How much energy did it expend, or how did it happen? Like anything like that?
Well, but think about that. Nazoth may not have been the strongest of the old gods, but he was an old god. A loon is capable of undoing his work.
Well, and that's why, like, I think the thing you're keying off of with Ardenweald is important too, because that corruption mirrored what we were seeing with the nightmare, the Emerald Nightmare. And if a loon is tied in some capacity to Ardenweald, or in a similar fashion with what's happening there, like, that would make sense to me because of how that sort of all went down. Because the corruption of the Tear of a Loon was more like the Emerald Nightmare corruption, for obvious reasons, instead of just flipping to void. And if you look at the Emerald Nightmare, it wasn't just void. It was almost like this reimagining of life, very similar to Nyalotha. So like when you're going through like the Ilganoth fight and you're looking through that corrupted world tree and the heart of Ilganoth and everything around it, it's not just like, oh, this is a void Tyrannosaurus Rex now. No, it's this is now aggressive and mutated and changed, fundamentally changed from what it was originally intended to be. It's not just like void elves that are like, oh, my skin's now voidy now. Sweet. It's not like Locust Walker, who's, well, I'm a void ethereal now. Sweet. Or even what we saw with the Seat of the Triumvirate, where that sort of corruption by the void was not necessarily a corruption, but more of a consuming. It was more of like a perversion. So if that can happen to a loon, maybe she is tied more to the Emerald Dream and possibly Ardenweald than we can possibly right now fathom. And I think that
I'm
was
sorry,
absolutely
did you say something after Void Tyrannosaur?
A couple things.
Lost it at that point. No, seriously, though, that was, I'm like, you're going, what? Wait, we can add a Void Tyrannosaurs? Why? No one told me that.
Maybe it'll be a mount in the future.
I think that's an interesting thing about this Shadowlands expansion that's happening, in that we're not going back to the same old stuff that we've seen over and over again. It's not going to be the Legion again. It's not going to be the old gods again. For better or for worse, this realm of death that we're about to experience is new and different to us. It's content we've not seen before. It's not rooted in any of the old Warcraft games, except in the most superficial, like, you know, we knew this, but all this other stuff we had no idea about. And I think that's the interesting thing about Ardenweald is very clearly the flip side of the Emerald Dream.
Mm-hmm.
It's like
the primal version of it.
And it's where the power of the Emerald Dream comes from. And it's, you know, because life comes from death. And that's something we started seeing signs of in this expansion with the Drust and the Kul'tiran kind of druids. Kul'tiran druids are very clearly death-based.
Oh, yeah. Drustfar drove that home real quick and real up front.
Yeah. And there's a lot of interesting things about this that I don't know. I don't know how it's going to shake out. And it comes back to that question about Tyrande, but I think we're going to see Tyrande learning more about, there's stuff even Tyrande doesn't know about a loon, because it's stuff you don't ask your god these questions, you know, there's no reason to. Your god is your god. So we're in a fascinating period of time. I'll put it that way.
I'm suddenly just very strangely, tangentially reminded of Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, where Shatner's sitting there being like, what does God need with us?
Well, clearly, I want to go somewhere. What's wrong with you, man?
Clearly.
Something, whales in space, something.
But yeah, but that's a very modern perspective on deity, the idea that your deity can do everything. We've never seen that. You know, there's a thing Velen, of all people, said. It's like the light does not operate unopposed in this world realm. It's like, you know, yeah, the light looks out for us, the light protects us, but the light isn't a guaranteed win for the light. If it was, there'd be no point to fighting it.
Yep.
You know, the light and the shadow are in contention for the souls of all existence. You know, these things are fighting, they are opposed forces. And that's never not been there. Like, we talked about, you know, that whatever a Loon is, it isn't a Titan. It isn't a Loa. It isn't anything, you know. Well, it kind of is a Loa because the word Loa just means
powerful, yeah, thing. Yeah.
Anything that we should worship, anything we should respect is a Loa. The trolls look at, you know, Night Elf wisps as Loa. They're not necessarily top tier ones, but, you know, it's nevertheless. So there's an interesting different worldview. And it's really fascinating to me to think about how did the Night Elves get from that worldview to the worldview they have now? And what is the Temple of Alun that we saw in Legion was the first Temple of Alun. And it was clearly a Titan facility. And it was clearly a Titan facility with stuff in it that it was based on Night Elves. And, like, did they get changed into that, like, by the Well of Eternity, in much the way that there are various Murlocs that get turned into the Jinyu? Was there, like, a, you know, is that how the Dark Trolls became what they are? We know there was something to do with the Well. There's a lot of this that we don't really know or understand. We don't really know or understand much about the Titans, despite having actually seen them at this point. We don't really know much about how they are operating or what they were really trying to do. We know they were trying to, quote-unquote, purify Azeroth from the, you know, old god, the necrophotic entity's corruption, but exactly how? What were they going for? How did they think this would work? How much of this is, you know, we're told Azeroth is relying on us, but how much of this is Azeroth's conscious mind? Does Azeroth have a conscious mind? What would you call that? Is that, like, you know, is Alun like that? Is she beyond that? Does she come from somewhere else? Is she, like, Azeroth's stepmom? You know, there's a lot of this we don't know, and it's interesting to think about that lack of knowledge, but you can't really make assumptions based on it.
Well, I think with that, we are over our time, which I'm going to start closing things out and bring us to our final thoughts. So Blizzard Watch is made possible due to the generous contributions at patreon.com/blizzardwatch. Your continued support means this podcast site and community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, a better chance at having your questions answered on our podcast or the queue, and an ads-free site experience. As always, please make sure you get your questions in, if you have any, to podcast@blizzardwatch.com. Just specify in the subject line which of the two podcasts you intend the question for, or if you are a member of our Patreon on our Discord, we do have a chat set aside specifically for those questions. And for those of you that have submitted those questions we didn't get to, don't worry, I still have them. We'll get to them next week. So final thoughts, y'all. Moving into the Shadowlands expansion with the idea of a Loon and just Tyrande and elves in general, if you could have a perfect storm, I guess, of those things coalescing, what would it be for you? What would bring you the most joy out of all those pieces coming together in the next expansion? I'll start with you, Crow.
Oh, man. There's an aspect of... There's an element of what I want out of Elune that leans into her as not only a goddess of light, but also a goddess of the natural world. Because I want to try and find a way to link... more strongly the notion of the Night Elves having this relationship with the living world, but also having this relationship with the moon, since the moon itself is something that is so in tune with the natural world itself. I'm really looking forward to seeing how that ends up being played out in Ardenvealed, because I think that is the place to do it, and it's something that, you know, that's something that's going to resonate for the work, and it's something that's probably going to resonate for post Sylvanas Forsaken, and for the Nightborne as well. So there's definitely a good cross-factional narrative that I think can touch on all of these things, aside from being something that reveals a lot of information for the Night Elves in particular. But that's certainly my perfect storm.
Rossi, what about you?
Honestly, I've been thinking about this for a while in terms of, like, we talked before about, like, possibly having other forms of druidism show up. Obviously, the, you know, Alun priesthood is not druidic. It's a priesthood. I would like to see the Night Elves finally go martial with it to a degree, and I'd like to see there being paladins come out of this, like Night Elf paladins, who deal with that whole the aspect of a loon as the light in the darkness,
mm-hmm.
because that's what, you know, they're a nocturnal people. That's what they are. The light of a loon is the light that they have. They don't, in a world where they didn't have to fight constantly, they wouldn't be running around during the day. They'd be sleeping during the day, and they'd be active at night. Not that they sleep very much, but you know what I'm saying? They're a nocturnal people. The reason that the moon is so important to them is in part that heritage of being the dark trolls, of being the night dwellers who look up and see the light of the moon, and that is their light. It's their light in the darkness. And I think that's the whole thing the Night Warrior refers to, in that the darkness is inherently part of that aspect. Elune isn't just the moon in the sky. She's the night. That's why they're the night elves. That's why Caldari literally means children of the stars.
Mm-hmm.
But they chose to call themselves night elves. And that's because, you know, that's when you see the stars at night. There are people that are, they're made up very much in that. So I want to see that aspect. I want to see, like, night elves finally go martial with it and have paladins as well as priests. I think it's been a long time on that one, and I think they've been teasing it for a long time. We saw them tease it pretty hard in Legion, where they actually had a night elf join the paladin order. So, yeah, I think that's more than enough time for that one to actually get done. And then I'd like to see I think to a certain degree Crow kind of talked about it, in that idea of it having consequences, because all the other night elves sort of turned away from Elune.
Mm-hmm.
Because Elune was their original goddess. This goes back, like, well before Ashara was ever born, well before they had much of an empire. As they were first starting out into the world, Elune was their goddess. And if you look at, like, even the druids today who have arcane spells, what are those arcane spells? Stuff like Moonfire.
Yep.
That's an arcane spell, and it's drawing on the power of the moon. So there is a possibility for Arcane to work with the moon. Imagine if Elune started making inroads among the other elves. Like right now, the blood elves, if they pray to anything, it's to just the light itself. And they didn't for a while. They'd given even that up. And now even, it's sort of, you know,
even their paladins is just light.
Yeah. So they don't have a divinity as such, because they turned their back on Elune because the priesthood of Elune wouldn't let them do arcane magic. But if they do allow that now, could you see, like, priests of Elune reaching out to the other elven people? Could that even, if you want to have Tyrande as your big bad in the game today, imagine if she actually starts a race war.
Yeah.
You know, ooh.
That's something that she might do. She might reach out to the other elves. She might say to the Nightborn, do you want to be part of these people who burn cities? What do you think is going to happen if they ever decide to burn yours?
And I mean, that's even a case you can make to the Blood Elves, because they're not too far away.
Yeah. There's an interesting, like, I mean, I don't think it would work, because I think they'd basically be more afraid of her than they would be of the Horde at this point, quite frankly. But well, you need to see what Ardenweald is and how it works with all this. But if we see that Elune is tied to this cycle of, like, life and rebirth and death, that's supposedly, you know, Ardenweald exists for things to die and go there, and their anima, their essence, to be passed back into the natural world. If Elune is tied to that cycle, one of the reasons that she might not have stopped what Sylvanas was doing was that she couldn't. Like, and the weird thing is, if you read that short story, Elune does act, but she acts by putting them all to sleep so they don't suffer. Why?
Now,
was it a case of her just being, you know, this is all I can do, or did she need them?
Did she need their souls because she's underpowered or burned so much of it already?
Yeah, yeah. Was she bringing them to her to use them herself? Like, you know, denying Sylvanas and her master their souls and taking them for herself. That's, I mean, I don't know, but it's something that I'd like to see dealt with.
Now, you hit on something that I've been thinking about for a little while too, and this is something that I was talking about with a bunch of my friends locally, which is Night Elf Paladins. And it's more of a case of, if we can have Blood Elf Paladins, why can't the Night Elf be Paladins? And you sort of hit on it where they've for the most part, it's complicated with their divinity as far as elves in general go. For me, that perfect storm would be a combination of all of the divergent paths of elven, like, pathos sort of coming together, or elven ethos coming together, where with the introduction of Ardenweald, we get to understand more about Alun and the cycle and how it's tied in there. But then we start to see how nature, arcane, and the embrace of Alun could be combined into essentially making elf paladins that can touch all of that, that can tap into that, that understand what Alun is finally, and have their faith, I don't want to say rewarded or boldened, but sort of expanded upon. And I think this would be a really cool opportunity. We talked about having like the fire druids, but I think the idea of having night elf paladins in this capacity is something that could, one, easily and tidily be tied up within the convergence of all of these aspects. And two, I think would be really interesting for development is to further of the elven story, because that's what spellbreakers were originally, is sort of the elven version of a paladin that touched on like arcane energies. Why not have something that taps into the arcane Alun and that nature, which seems to be, at least from the descriptions of Ardenweald, what goes on in Ardenweald.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Cenarius, who's, how many times has that dude died and come back?
Oh, yeah.
Cenarius's mom is Alun.
Yeah. Yep.
Right.
And that's never really, we don't really ever stop to think
about.
It's
never been dealt with. Yeah.
You know, Cenarius's mother is Alun, directly. Alun is his mother.
And Cenarius is responsible for teaching the druids.
Yeah, but that's just, think about what that means in terms of what Alun is. Whatever Alun is, she can give birth to Cenarius.
Yep.
And coincidentally, Cenarius looks like half a night elf and half a deer.
Yeah, well, because dad was a deer. I mean, come on.
Yeah. I know. That's the thing. He's not getting the night elf part from his dad. He's getting the deer part from dad, which must mean that, you know, that the night elf part of it has got to come from the Alun side of things.
Because well, it's not coming from the Temple of Alun. Yeah. I agree with you there, because if you look at the Temple of Alun, and I know we're going way long, Joe, I'm sorry.
No, you're
if you look
fine.
At the Temple of Alun, there's all those images that would look like night elves.
Yep.
But what if they're not night
elves?
What if
they're pictures of Alun? Yep.
Just every one of those. And what if it was Alun in the temple who's using the four Titan, the Pillars of Creation? I keep wanting to call it the Pillars of Eternity, and I hate that, but that game was pretty good. So. If they're using the Pillars of Creation, if it's Alun who's supposed to be using them, and one of them is the Tear of Alun,
mm-hmm.
What if there needs to be more?
Part of me
dealt with on this before I can say anything, but it definitely seems to be something there.
Part of me still feels like Alun is an entity that sits at the top of Ardenweald and has been manifesting using the spirit of that energy or of that realm to manifest and affect the material plane, or as has been happening. And that the soul drought is intrinsically linked with Alun expending so much power recently. Like, that's kind of what I want to see. I don't know if that's actually the case, but I wouldn't be surprised if we see, like, this light-infused nature throne, and upon it sits this, you know, almost Eladrin-esque Alun.
Yeah. I'd sign up for that. That sounds great.
If we don't stop talking, we'll never get out of here. So I'm gonna...
But thank you all for joining us. Crow, thank you so, so much for joining us this week. I wasn't going to do this earlier, but I'm going to do it now because I feel like it. Happy birthday. I hope that you had fun.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And everybody, we will see you next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.